Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Business Brew. This episode features Hunter Hopcroft of Armada ETF Advisors. Hunter is a managing director at Armada. He also writes the blog, or I guess it's not a blog, it is a Substack, Lewis Enterprises, and one of his recent posts broke down the different ways that you can calculate the cap rate that Blackstone ended up paying for apartment income communities. I think that Hunter's very I know he's very knowledgeable about the REIT space, and there was somebody that said REITs are trash, and I pinged him and I said, do you want to come on and talk about REITs a little bit? Because that's an area that he's been focused on. As you know, this program has somewhat of a multifamily interest, and I think it's important to highlight the different investment vehicles. We had a private conversation a little bit ago. We had a public one a while ago with Bill Chen, and now we have this one. So I hope that you enjoy, and I hope that it adds to your educational experience. A quick PS on the intro. I would be remiss if I didn't tell you to stick around to the end of the conversation where Hunter waxes poetic on Marty Whitman, so a legend in the game that is under-discussed. As always, nothing in the show is financial advice. Please consult an investment advisor before making investment decisions. Everything in this show is for entertainment purposes and educational purposes, and do your own due diligence. All right, ladies and gentlemen, excited to be joined by Hunter Hopcroft. Is it Hopcroft or Hopcroft?
Hopcroft, but no one ever gets it right. So,
no. All right. Well, you know, then I have a large audience that I'm part of people that get it wrong. Anyway, thank you for joining.
Thanks so much for having me. I feel like you get such great guests. I feel like I've kind of like snuck into the side to.
Oh, no, this is fake news. This is fake news. This is going to be a good one. I am excited to chat with you. You're one of the people that if I mention that I have a private LP investment in real estate, you pop in and educate me about how bad of an idea that is. I say that half joking. But, you know, like what was the conversation that came up? Somebody said REITs are a crappy asset class, right? Like by definition. And I think that was one of the catalysts for us wanting to have a conversation. So among many, do you want to set the stage a little bit and talk about what you do and what you used to do, where you are now and why you're where you are?
Sure. That's probably a good place to start because I've sort of transitioned my career around a belief in this structure. So I feel like since I was a junior in high school that I wanted to be in asset management, but I went to a small liberal arts school. My first job out was with a relatively large RIA, and put yourself back in the 2010-2011 timeframe. This is immediately post GFC, and that sort of Swenson style endowment management is coming down market to high net worth and ultra high net worth. So my first job was essentially underwriting or taking a look at all of these, the first vintage of non-traded REITs, oil and gas partnerships. I mean, really nasty stuff on the private markets. And at the time, I was like, this is not what I thought being an investor was going to be like. But in time, I've come to appreciate sort of going through all those docs and kind of learning where the bodies were buried. And now we've had kind of a revival of these with things like BREITs and sort of this second wave of alternatives coming down market, especially after all the alternative managers went public. The juice had been squeezed as much from the pension and endowment space as it possibly could have, and so these started coming down market to grow. My previous job was at another RIA doing primarily private real estate allocations for one family. And, you know, this is as we're leading up to the sort of run-up of post-COVID 21 and 22. And I'm looking at all these funds and private placements, and I'm looking at what I can go out and buy in the public markets on the real estate side, and it just started making less and less sense to me. And as I dug more and more into REITs, I really felt more and more strongly that that was a place that was going to be a beneficiary on the other side of that. And I think we're in the very beginning innings of seeing that play out. The last couple of take privates where Blackstone picked up Tricon and Air Communities, and then the cost of capital advantage REITs have is starting to come to the fore as we may enter a higher for longer environment. So I transitioned from sort of being a private allocator to now where I am, which is a REIT-focused asset manager called Armada. And we have a few listed products, but we also do SMAs and some sub-advisory work all around the REIT space and using a variety of factors to build REIT portfolios that are, we believe, highly differentiated from what you can buy in a cap-weighted product.
So you said that you were looking at the what you could get in the private markets, and then you were looking at the REIT space in the public markets. And I believe you said something like it didn't make sense to me. And I think what you were alluding to was the discount that the private market REITs were trading at relative to private market. Is that correct?
Well, just to sort of give a case study that might be illustrative, you know, a big thing obviously was private multifamily had a great run up in 20 and 21. And when you get a private placement offering for one of those, obviously the sponsor includes their rent growth and exit cap assumptions. And what I was really alluding to was if I took, you know, one of the beauties of real estate and one of the reasons it's a little bit more tangible to underwrite is because the assets are largely homogenous. A 300 unit garden multifamily building that owned by a REIT is the same type of building in almost every way that a private operator would buy. So if you looked at what their rent growth rates, how they were going to reduce expenses, and what they were, you know, underwriting as an exit cap, and if you just took those exact same assumptions and laid them on top of like a Mid-America or a Camden Property Trust, what you were able to buy the Camden Property Trust for was at a much, much lower multiple than what they wanted you to contribute equity for this private deal. Now, of course, and we don't have to go down this estuary. I've written about this, that in many ways, the not marking to market, the lack of visible volatility was the product there, not the underlying investment. So, but that's a different type of analysis that you're doing when you're making decisions along those lines.
And I apologize. I don't know whether or not you think that I'm going to call it volatility laundering, for lack of a better term. Why do you think that product deserves to exist in the market? I mean, it's clearly got a place, and people are clearly okay with it. I guess the other thing that you do notice when you look at public REITs versus some of the private ones is the LTVs appear much lower in the public ones, at least in multifamily.
Well, you could think of your personal balance sheet. You would also run maybe a lot lower leverage if you were marked to market every day. So
yeah, that's true.
If your equity was getting marked every day, it somewhat limits your ability to take on a lot of leverage. Although some REITs do. Why should the private products exist? Well, keep in mind, I think it's been other than sort of small time syndications, it's a relatively recent phenomenon that large funds have come down market. That was prior the purview of pensions and endowments that had a lot more governance oversight and were sort of structurally incapable of taking on a lot of volatility. They have stakeholders whose retirements and those stakeholders don't want to see a number bouncing all around, and I get that. In terms of why they exist for high net worth and ultra high net worth investors, it's very hard in any market these days to have an analytical edge. It's incredibly costly to have a data edge, but it's possible to have a behavioral edge. And I think the pitch to these, and really it's worth remembering, these are mediated by financial advisors. Very few individual investors, I'm not even sure you can, as an individual investor with just a, you know, Interactive Brokers account, can go out and buy BREIT. You have to be mediated through an RIA anyway. The idea was that these people are going to, you know, if we can have a section of the portfolio that is illiquid, it will lead to better outcomes. Even if it is just volatility laundering, because the friction of getting in and out will help reduce bad decision making. And I don't know if that was explicitly the case, but I think it was certainly part of it. I think the other part of it was in the independent RIA community and sort of independent wealth managers, there was private equity that came into that marketplace as well. And that was the easiest pitch in the world, was for these large alt managers to say, hey, would you like to lock 10 or 15% of your book up in really sticky assets? And I think that would improve the multiple when those wealth managers and RIAs went to exit or sell their business if there was a certain amount of assets that were sort of structurally sticky. Again, I don't think any of this was implicit, but that's the thing about markets, is that these incentive structures kind of lead to a certain outcome regardless of how explicit they are.
So we've talked a little bit about the bad incentive structures or the suboptimal potentially in the private world. What are some of the knocks and the sort of negative incentive structures of a public REIT? I know one of the issues is they can't really keep, they don't retain their earnings, right? So they distribute them. So you get this, they're constantly issuing shares, which is a complaint a lot of people have. So curious to hear you riff on that and then whatever else you know from being an expert that I don't.
Well, it's funny. I think you mentioned you're sort of half jokingly said this episode was going to be called In Defense of REITs. And I think a lot of the source of that viewpoint comes when you compare a REIT to an operating company or a stock that doesn't have these constraints like a Google. So there's just, or just sort of what's in vogue in markets right now, generally. What's in vogue in markets is being very asset light, having a really long and sort of wide open reinvestment runway, buying back shares. You know, these are what are in vogue for equities and have been for the past.
Share-based comp is pretty in vogue. But yeah.
You know, and so when someone looks at a REIT, it has none of those characteristics. It's obviously, it's asset heavy. It has a mandated return of shareholder capital in the form of cash dividends. So it does have to issue shares to grow. There's just a lot of features that are not in vogue from an equity standpoint. And when I talk about REITs, I'm not saying you should own a REIT instead of your mega cap tech. I just think the combination of growth and income has a role in portfolios generally that's being overlooked. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing that's kind of difficult about REITs is they have sort of famously bad governance. A lot of REITs are domiciled either in Maryland or in Georgia. There's a 550 rule where no more than five investors can own more than 50%. And so it makes REIT activism, and it really limits shareholder governance considerably. And in fact, the large asset managers, so like your Vanguards or your BlackRocks, that would potentially be tripping up the rule on some of these have exemptions, and they don't want to lose that sort of waiver. And so they typically vote with management. And so you have not the greatest governance setup. You have this mandated return of cash, which sometimes, you know, is not the best tax advantage for certain types of investors, but we can maybe get into the misconceptions around private and public tax incentives of real estate. But I think those are some of the like sort of structurally things that REITs are overcoming. But I do think the tide is turning a little bit as rates stay. It seems crazy to talk about rates being high, you know, in the long march of history, but higher than where they were and higher than where people have been getting used to equity returns. I think there's going to be a bit of return to a cash nexus, a bigger focus on cash shareholder return of capital. And I also think as long as inflation is an open question or something people are debating, these hard asset bases are going to also kind of come back into vogue relative to being asset light.
Huh. Interesting. My thought is if you are asset light and you have pricing power, inflation does not hurt you in the same way that it could hurt you should you need to reinvest in your asset base. So why do you think that an asset heavier company may be more in vogue in a higher interest rate environment?
Well, I guess it's two sides of the same coin, because for the exact same reason you said that, oh, it's going to be harder to invest in your physical capital, it also makes it much harder for any of your competitors or any new entrants to invest in that physical capital. And perhaps from a performance standpoint, this is not the best example, but the hard asset base of a railroad company or a utility is a very big moat relative to potential new entrants. So there's that element to it. And then we can also get into the degree to which people believe or don't believe real estate can be an inflation hedge in terms of rental rates. But I think all of those things, as we leave a ZIRP world, these hard asset companies, whether they're REITs or other companies with large asset bases, may start to look more interesting relative to what's happening in the tech space.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you know Bill Chen, and Bill Chen was a guest on the show. And, you know, one thing that he had said to me that I think makes some intuitive sense to me is, you know, REITs enable you to diversify among geographies. They enable you to diversify among tenant bases, and they tend to have rents that will rise at least in line with inflation. So to me, you know, I look at it and I say, okay, well, if I wanted to maybe make 1-2% real returns, a REIT versus, I don't know, like there seems to be sillier ideas out there. It seems to be a fairly low downside with maybe a couple ways to make real decent returns structure. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out where I'm wrong on that, but that's kind of been how I've been thinking about them.
Well, I think if you look at Bill's thesis, which he laid out on the podcast really well, is what you have is a pretty clear line of sight on a low to mid double digit IRR over 5 years, but the distribution's really tight. It's not going to shoot the lights out, and you're probably not going to have some downside scenario. What are the bear cases? What is the downside scenario? Well, one would be a really deep recession that really impacted household formation negatively, which is certainly a risk, but I don't think there's not going to be many places to hide in that scenario. And then the other bear case is somehow the C's part and the U.S. built a lot more housing, which also seems unlikely. And the multifamily housing starts numbers are at, like, you know, 5-10 year nadirs. So that's not even really a possibility until you look out to 27 or 28. So,
well, you're getting a lot of deliveries, right? So there's a fair amount of supply coming on in the short term.
What's interesting about
that, at least in certain markets,
what's interesting about that, though, is absorption has stayed really high. And it's kind of it's a little bit counterintuitive, I guess I could say, is that you need new supply to have high absorption. Like, the markets with the most supply have the highest absorption because there has to be supply to absorb. And it's certainly been true on the higher end. From the REIT aspect, that seemed to be reflected in housing REIT pricing over last summer. And now I think the market, as a discounting mechanism, is looking forward to that 25-26 supply dearth and wondering where people are going to live and what rental rates look like. Rent growth has flattened, and I think even Bill Chen, you know, is modeling maybe a year or two of negative. But then once you hit that sort of pothole of no new supply in 25 and 26, it could reaccelerate really quickly. So when you look at a point to point, you're still looking at, you know, 2-4% rent growth, some expense growth, and then the NOI growth. Even if you sort of model flat cap rates from here, it starts to look pretty compelling. And now it looks compelling to me as someone who's very happy with a low double-digit return with high visibility. It probably does not look appealing to investors who have been long NVIDIA for the past 12 months. And there's really nothing I can say to combat that. It's just a different style of investing.
Yeah. Well, and to your point, what I forget what you'd said once. I think you said if you have over like a 25% allocation to real estate, I'd argue that it's probably not the most well. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but basically, like, this is an asset class as a part of a portfolio.
Right.
It is not the end-all, be-all asset class.
Exactly, exactly. It plays a role. I think 5-15% allocation to, whether it's real estate or these type of dynamics where you have growth and income, And that can come from a lot of different types of companies. But I think that growth and income element of the portfolio is an important stalwart and should help, you know, especially when you have periods where stock and bond correlations start to look very alike. This growth and income, this sort of these instruments or these structures like BDCs or like REITs that have some bond-like characteristics and some equity-like characteristics can be a really valuable part of a portfolio.
Why do you think that?
If you look at, so let's go back to the multifamily REITs again, but you could look at it really, I guess, any REIT asset class. When you have a dividend that is, let's say, between 3 and 5% right now, with a line of sight on dividend growth, you know, and you start to worry less about multiple, these things start to behave a little bit like the bond portion, but how your bond portion should act relative to, you know, your equities or your equities with no cash return. There's a sense in which the equity in these is actually more volatile than the underlying asset base. And I think that's why these privates have proliferated the way they have, is because the people were anathema to that. Like that's not what they wanted from this. They didn't want a volatile equity. They wanted just the asset returns. But to me, that part of them is what provides such great opportunities in this space, is when you're able to look at this asset base that has contractual cash flows, it's relatively stable, it's secured by a hard asset, and identify value much easier to me, or just clicks with me more than trying to define flow-based multiples from operating companies about what next quarter or next year's or 3 years EBITDA is going to be. So I think it's just a different type of investment style that is a good balance to where a lot of the equity market is now, which again is asset light, no shareholder return of capital outside of buybacks, which are mostly sterilizing share-based compensation, that these two are kind of at opposite ends of the equity structure spectrum.
It's an interesting time. The buyback sterilizing the stock-based comp, I'm still not sure how I want to think about it. The ever-famous post-market on the Twitter machine once called it Phantom OpEx is what they called it, and I thought that I liked that. I thought that was a good comment.
Yeah, and I think I've talked to people that kind of model it that way. Now, you end up in the same place, right? Because a lot of these companies are investing through the income statement, and that really should be treated as CapEx. And then so you're swapping one for the other, and you may end up in the exact same place. But I do think it's worthwhile. I mean, I don't know if you've been following Daniel Paris. He's a history investor. You know, he just wrote a book called The Ownership Dividend. He's making a case for the return of dividend investing. Of course, lots of sort of finance.
Oh, I think I got reached out to by that person.
Yeah, he's great.
To be on the pod.
Yeah, he's great. And I
should
think
I have him on? I should have him on.
You should definitely have him on. He did a great Hidden Forces, not to plug someone else's pod on yours.
That's fine. Hey, if it's great, it's great. This is about curating dope shit, not about keeping everybody on my stuff.
But, you know, it's at least sort of a divergent view from where a lot of investors and certainly all of academic finance is. And I think it's worth considering that, you know, his main point is that a dividend you get as the result of business ownership. It's the natural outcome of business ownership. The business produced profit that was distributed to you. The return of capital you get from a share buyback is the result of a financial transaction, and that difference is not insignificant. And that's probably as deep as I would go without putting words in Daniel's mouth, but I do think there's something.
This is a podcast. You can put all kinds of words in people's mouth. They can't even do anything against it. I will have him on. I will. Because I tend to, I go back and forth with Jake, Conopic or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Because I am certain, well, I believe I'm certain, which again, that means I'm 70% sure, that the buyback is to a robot, like, and in a textbook, a far superior return of capital, because if I don't want the dividend, I can defer my taxes. If I think they're buying back at an improper price, I can sell into it. If I think it's too cheap, I can add my ownership. Like, I get all that. I think that there is something about a dividend, and yes, dividends can be cut, but I think there's something about it where if, as a person, if I have a balance sheet that is not stretched and I have income that is paying for a decent or all of my life, I think it gives the ability to compound for the rest of the portfolio. It releases a tension.
That,
for me,
that is a much better answer than the one I gave for why I think that this is an important part of portfolios.
Oh, it's the same thing, right? It's
right.
It's
that income, that dividend income provides some margin of safety that I think is not insignificant, and that I do think is, even if the academics disagree, qualitatively different than a share buyback. To bring us back to REITs, but to tie this in, I mean, in the early 19th century, when companies were paying dividends, and paying dividends was, you know, de rigueur if you were a publicly traded company, it's because they were investing and they needed to entice people to buy the stock. And the way you enticed people to buy the stock was with a dividend, because they needed capital. What happened in sort of the current market structure is, these companies don't really need the capital from shareholders. They're retiring shares, not issuing them. And so the REITs pay a dividend. They sort of have to do, and again, that's mandated to protect their tax status. It's 90% of net income has to go out. So that they have to pay that dividend, they are going to be issuers of shares, and that dividend helps create a market for those shares. To me, especially in an asset class like REITs, where the governance is maybe not that great, and management skill varies widely, that sort of capital allocation discretion, I'm very happy to have out of their hands.
Yeah. That's interesting. I guess I didn't realize that a dividend was there to entice people to buy the shares, but that makes sense. I mean, the way that the world used to work.
Early Moody's manuals used to quote the dividend per mile of track for railroads. There was this very, very tangible connection between the dividend and the physical capital the company was investing in or creating.
That's interesting. There you have it. In what you're doing, do you have any biases as far as asset classes within REITs? Do you have a multifamily team? Do you view multifamily the same as office? I mean, obviously they all trade at different cap rates and whatnot, but like, are you pretty agnostic as to the asset class?
I think the most important thing to note about this, and maybe I'll highlight by differentiation, is how the REIT asset class looks if you capitalization weight it. So,
okay. Towers?
What?
Towers, like way up there?
Towers are way up there. Data centers are way up there.
Yeah.
You know, things that, if we look at the S&P 500, and we, you know, there's been lots of hay made this year about the concentration of the top seven companies in the S&P 500. But in fairness, I'm talking to you on a Microsoft computer. We exchanged emails over Gmail. Like, when I look at the top of the index and I think about my day-to-day life, I'm interacting with those seven companies very regularly. When I came into work today, I commute from Brooklyn to Manhattan. I passed apartment buildings. I passed offices. I passed retail centers. I did not pass data centers and cell towers or industrial facilities. And that is what's at the top of the REIT index. And I don't think there's necessarily a logical reason why the equity cap weight, the float adjusted equity cap weight of a REIT would justify its weighting in a passive index, other than that's just, it's sort of the world's dumbest algorithm. So to answer, we just don't view the benchmark or the index or specifically the market cap as a very strong signal of performance or what people are looking for from a factor or risk exposure and what they want out of a REIT allocation. Two quick examples. Prologis is the highest weighting in most REIT indices. It's about 100 in the, well, it's different today, but let's say $130 billion market cap. So if you don't own your home and you're just invested in the index, Prologis is your highest, your biggest real estate investment as sort of a median American. And I bet most people have never even heard the name of the company.
Do they do industrial?
Yeah, they're the world's largest owner of industrial as well. Second thing is like, I think people, when they look at their real estate allocation, assume that there's a lot of residential in there. But in reality, at a cap weight, residential is only around 10 or 12% of the REIT index. And so there's like lots of things that and we know this isn't right because it doesn't comp to the private market. Okay. So if you look at the US commercial real estate market is right around $20 trillion. The market cap of all listed REITs is like $1.2, $1.3 trillion. So we're talking about a very small segment of the commercial real estate market that's even represented in listed vehicles. But if you look at how the private market is allocated and, you know, look at a BREIT, for example, they're not overweight cell towers and data centers. They own multifamily housing and industrial. If you look at NCREIF, which is sort of the private market, Odyssey, it's called open-end developed core equity, which is sort of open-end private funds. They have, you know, office in the REIT index is only around 8%. It's you know, in the teens for Odyssey. So the private market doesn't match the public market at all in terms of how real estate assets are allocated. So this giant divergence between the equity market cap of what's listed and how the private market is allocated should signal that something's not right with that approach to your REIT sleeve of your portfolio.
Yeah. Huh. The idea of providing shelter to people is one of those things that I just like inherently understand. You know, now I understand industrial and I understand office and stuff, but like I like being low on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Especially if inflation is sticky and people have to start making choices, like where you live seems to be like one of those places that people are going to choose to have shelter.
The U.S. is very unique. I mean, one thing that's very unique about the U.S. is the existence of the 30-year mortgage. That is a tremendous benefit bestowed upon us by King Dollar. But the rest of the world does not have the same home ownership dynamic that we do or have had for many years. And to refrain from making a value judgment about whether a shift away from that home ownership dynamic is good or bad, I think it's unreasonable or maybe not the best way to view it that we would be able to resist the same path that most other countries in the global economy have gone down with a greater renter base than ownership base. We certainly seem to be moving that direction, and I'm not really sure what would reverse it.
Okay, so said differently, you think there's going to be more renters in the future relative to owners than there are now.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, now there's some sort of, I think, tail cases in terms of demographics about that you can make a change in sort of like what the supply of homes would be. But it's still, for most people, home buying is a utility decision, not a financial decision. So they don't really, you know, millennials or Generation Z, I don't know if they want to own a home so bad that they want to own a home 40 miles from the city center. I don't know that they, you know, there's sort of those dynamics in play that it's not purely a supply demand element of housing prices.
Yeah. Well, if they get enough kids, they may choose 40 miles is not so bad.
Another trend that is not looking like it's heading in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So what are y'all trying to do to put a point on it? You're trying to mimic the private market allocation or do something slightly different?
I think that's an element of it. We certainly want to keep an eye towards that and more of an eye towards that than an eye towards what this sort of arbitrary benchmark is saying that we should be in. Now, for our listed products, it's very much a quantitative systematic system that is looking at quality, price, momentum, looking at and also pulling in private market data around rent growth, population growth, and all of those things. An interesting thing about REITs, and I imagine it's true for a lot of asset-heavy pass-through companies, if you think about Fama French, you know, depending on what study you look at and explain something like, you know, more than 95% of equity price movements can be explained by the Fama fringe factors. That number is less than 50% for REITs. So we're sort of coming from this angle that there are factors that are specific and unique to REITs that can be helpful in predicting forward returns. And so we have a system built that is scanning. There's only about 160 REITs with enough liquidity, U.S. listed REITs with enough liquidity. So when you apply all of that kind of computing power to a smaller universe, you can do a lot more things and run a lot more tests. And so we have one strategy that's essentially equal weight housing, equal weight all of the housing REITs. And we tested a million things, but equal weight works really well for that sector and has. And one of the things it has is like there's a small cap premium, but not the same reason there's a small cap premium for equities. There's a small cap premium because, as we've seen, they get taken out. It's run fundamentally a roll-up strategy. So when you're coming out of an inflection point, these small cap REITs start getting gobbled up either by other REITs or by private equity, usually at 20 to 30% premiums. And so Tricon Residential was bought by Blackstone as an equal weight strategy. We were holding that at like 4% versus 0.04% in the market cap index. You know, Air Communities snapped up by Blackstone at a 25% premium. We're holding that at 4% instead of like a, you know, less than 1% in the cap weighted index. So that's one strategy. And then on the other side, we have sort of our go that looks at the entire universe, not just residential. So that the residential one, I think, is sort of speaking to what Bill Chen is talking about of kind of this tactical opportunity in residential right now. The other strategy looks at the entire REIT universe and is looking for essentially where price, quality, and momentum are aligning. And so we're out of data centers in that strategy. We're way underweight industrial.
Mark Ganzi's mad at you.
Well, you know, well, we can get a digital bridge later. We'll save that for like the epilogue.
Yeah, that's
the
fine.
Epilogue. But we're actually slightly overweight office in that strategy. Certainly overweight office relative to the index. We're overweight residential in that strategy. Also, again, relative to the index. And that's just because we're on this, you know, quality, price, and momentum. And this subsector allocation is very important. You know, avoiding the bottom three subsectors of REITs can be a very good strategy if you can figure out, or at least underweighting the bottom three subsectors of REITs can be a very, very good strategy that's not, I don't think, impossible to implement.
I had read, and maybe I'm misremembering what I read, but I'm pretty sure that I read that office REITs have been the best performing REIT sector this year. Is that true or is that fake news?
That was true earlier in the year. Part of that was a bit of a short squeeze that happened at the end of last year.
But I mean, it makes sense. I knew they weren't the best performing over 5 years. I just thought over 1 year, maybe it was true.
Yeah, that may have been true like in February because they had sort of like caught a bid at pivot talks at the beginning of fourth quarter, and I think kind of got squeezed out a little bit. Office REITs is a fascinating sector. You know, this entire asset class, people, and just like this conversation sort of revealing, people think of it as a monolith right up until the time they don't. You know, so prior to COVID, everyone had their little REIT allocation, and then COVID happens, and then people start asking, oh my God, how much office do I have? How much San Francisco exposure do I have?
Yeah, what do I
own? What do I actually own in this thing? And so even within office, there's all sorts of interesting dynamics. And a lot of the office REITs are relatively, you know, there's very few kind of like nationwide office REITs. You know, BXP, you know, has a lot, that's in a lot of markets, but most of them are concentrated. You know, there's a handful of West Coast REITs. There's a handful of New York REITs. There's a handful of suburban REITs, and those tend to be geographic focused. We talked about office as a monolith, but those are all very different market dynamics for what's going on even within those. One thing that's interesting about the real estate space, and I guess you could argue this is now becoming true of a lot of other asset classes. I just feel like the path towards this started earlier in commercial real estate, is the availability and proliferation of private market data about real estate seems to grow every day. And again, we have this sort of asset homogeneity that can be very beneficial. So I can look daily at where things are trading in the private market in San Francisco, in Dallas. I can look at vacancy rate. I can look at where new leases are being signed. And you can extend that information and that analysis to what's happening, you know, in those public structures well before they do their quarterly release. Now, depending on your level of belief in efficient market hypothesis, you might say that doesn't matter. I would say that there's just not enough or a meaningful, you know, there's just not a ton of interest in this asset class. So I think there's still a ton of opportunity in getting into the weeds on some of this stuff. You know, West Coast, for example, there's a bit of like a situation, you know, there's a bit of a dynamic going on where some of the more suburban, older vintage kind of four-story brick and smaller square footage are leasing better than like the sexy downtown glass boxes. I don't think that's something you would intuitively know unless you were looking regularly at private market data to sort of see these dynamics playing out.
Huh. That's interesting. Are you dare suggesting that some large private equity firms don't have a data advantage over the rest of the market?
I heard a great line the other day, which is if Blackstone only knew what Blackstone knew, they'd be unstoppable.
Well, I think they're pretty good at what they do as it is.
I'm sure they're working on Blackstone GPT as we speak.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. I liked your breakdown of the cap rates of the Blackstone deal. Do you mind going through sort of the different ways that you can break down what Blackstone actually paid for AIRC?
Yeah, so
you don't have to do the whole thing. No, I mean, I wrote it up, but I'm just...
I did that analysis. When that press release came out on Monday, you know, I've still got a foot kind of, I've got a foot in private markets and a foot in public markets. And the discourse in the private markets, yeah, cap rate is a shorthand multiple that people describe the same way people in public markets talk about PE ratios or EBITDA ratio multiples. So everyone wants to know when a big trade happens, what's the cap rate? What's the cap rate? And a lot of my purpose of going through that analysis was to show it's kind of whatever you want it to be. You know, way NOI is not a sharply defined measure of cash flows, especially for REITs. Something that a lot of people are surprised to find on multifamily REITs is that they take property management expenses out after the NOI line, which is at first blush is like, well, why would you do that? Obviously, property management is a economic cost of owning the property, but you have to take that out of reported NOI. And there's all sorts of nuances like this. JV interest, whether or not you're going to capitalize general and administrative expenses and pull that out before you get to a cap rate. What was interesting to me about that deal and specifically what they paid, let's call it mid fives just to simplify. They paid a mid five cap rate for that, which I think is, to me, was the $10 billion number that they paid or that was at least cited in that was one that satisfied everyone's fiduciary responsibility and egos. I do not think it was arrived at based on an extensive cap rate analysis. But when the deal hit, Air Communities was spun out of Aimco because of these properties were stabilized. These were core properties. And so when Blackstone bought it, when I first saw the headline, I assumed it was going in BREIT, which is more of a core strategy for them. You know, they're shooting for like an 8-12 IRR on those investments. But then I found out that they were putting this portfolio into Blackstone Real Estate Opportunities, which is their opportunistic fund, Blackstone Real Estate Partners, BREP, which has a much higher return hurdle. So I think the question, what was the impetus for writing that was, you're buying these core assets, you're putting them in an opportunistic fund and kind of doing the Mobison expectations investing. What needs to be true for you to hit your hurdle buying them into this particular cost of capital structure, which, you know, is more like mid-teens? And essentially, they kind of have to have 2-4% NOI growth, and they really can't have any cap rate expansion over the next, you know, 5-7 years, which is really interesting to me. To me, it seemed like a pretty low margin of safety in this. But then on the other hand, that strategy just raised $30 billion. That's an insane amount of money to put out the door. Perhaps they're buying Air Communities to like ensure multifamily beta in that portfolio, and then they'll create returns with other deals. I'm not sure, but I think it was less about the cap rate and more about the cap rate relative to their cost of capital and the structure it was going into. And so it'll be interesting to see. Something I left out of my write-up, which is worth noting, is that on that $10 billion acquisition, BREP disclosed a $400 million CapEx program. So I think they're probably seeing a little bit of what we talked about earlier, where you get into 25, 26, you don't have any new supply. The Air Communities portfolio, they're a little bit older vintage, but they're, for the most part, what people would consider Class A apartment buildings, that Blackstone's going to do this CapEx program and make sure that in these markets that are going to run up against low supply in the coming years, these are the nicest places to live. And so they're going to push rents.
Yeah.
They're going to push rents on that. And then I think hope and pray that they get some rate relief sometime in the next 5 years and probably flip it to regional PE firms or spin it back out. But that's like such a specific thesis to put $10 billion towards.
Well, my buddy works for a firm and he had me at this lunch that Schwartzman talked at. And he said, he's like, if you look at what interest rate, Schwartzman said, and I'll probably butcher it, but directionally this is correct. He said, if you look at where interest rates are, it's not hard to figure out, if you can think long enough, you're probably not going to have much development. And usually when you don't have much development down the road, rents go up.
Sometimes it really is that easy.
I mean, he was like, this isn't rocket science, you know? And he was saying, like, and in his view, he thought the Fed was behind the curve because, you know, they're looking at inflation data that's lagging. And he's like, all you got to do is look at current data, and it looks like we're going to have to play catch up at some point. So I would not be shocked if you're directionally correct in what you think they are thinking.
Private market cap rates, even in hot markets, where stuff is trading, is still trading very tight. I think there's a element, as much as the term is overused, there's a lot of dry powder earmarked for real estate that is going to get deployed. And so I don't know when or how you actually get the multiple expansion that people have been expecting on meetings, just because there's so many assets that are mandated to be buying real estate. You know, I think stuff is still, like in Miami, you know, multifamily assets are still trading sub 5 caps, even in this rate environment. Multifamily starts are way down. So it's interesting to see how it's playing out. And I think there's still some muscle memory from 08. You know, there's lots of doom and gloom about commercial real estate on the debt side. But I've told many people, I think the muscle memory from 08 is don't let anybody go bankrupt just because they're out of money. And any distress is going to be very slow rolled, and that anyone who's waiting for kind of the big one is going to be disappointed in this cycle. It doesn't mean that there's great values out there right now. I just don't think that there's a whole lot of upside in sitting on your hands and waiting for a washout that just might not ever happen.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Why do you think that the cap rates in the private markets are still so tight? Or I shouldn't frame it that, but are not maybe where you think they would be?
Yeah, I mean, I think this comes back to earlier in our conversation when we were talking about the rent growth. Is something, I mean, you have to pay to go into a deal with what's almost surely negative leverage, to be paying a 5 cap when your cost of debt is 6 or 6.5 or sometimes higher. You have to believe really strongly in this rent growth story. That's really unless property is being very, you know, assets are being mismanaged and there's lots of OPEX to cut out. You have to believe that this rent growth trend continues. And so I think that is, you know, troubling that so many people continue to believe that this rent growth trend is solid. That's almost never a good sign in some sense that this is consensus that rent growth will be strong for 26. And then the other side of that is what we were just talking about, where there's a lot of cash that's mandated to buy real estate right now, and there's not that many assets coming to market. I don't think it's a market where sellers are particularly excited to face the market where debt costs are right now. You know, the market was so hot, they had brokers calling. You know, if you're an owner of multifamily, if you were an owner of industrial, you had a broker calling you every day giving you an appraisal. You know exactly what your property is worth, or at least was worth when rates were much lower, and you're kind of anchored on that number. So you have a lot of capital chasing very few assets coming to market, and then you've got this belief in the rent growth coming largely from this supply story. So I think that's keeping cap rates really tight. what causes that dam to break? Again, I'm not sure because I don't see a scenario where lots of people are foreclosed on at once, or there's a big flood of supply from the selling standpoint, or you know, of properties coming onto the market. I think if you're a seller, the stuff that's happening now is truly more or less forced sellers for one way, and there's just not that many of them.
I want to be careful how I say this, but if the banks are less willing to, I guess the way that I could say it is, when I was at the bank, you know, when you had a group of entities that were in a sector that were problem credits, you were definitely less likely to extend more credit to them. And if you could get it out of the bank, that was a nice problem to have, right? I mean, the goal was always to rehab the credit and to get it back on the line. But, you know, it's not as if you can now go to private credit and refi your way out of this stuff, right? The bank cost of capital is your lowest cost of capital. So the debt only gets more expensive, right? So to your point, I guess you may have forced sellers. What, it's the people that have delivered now a developed project and can't lock in the debt that are the sellers?
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, or just
development. Somebody's got a 5-year roll or something.
Development's hung, bridge debt that's coming due. That's a lot of the bear case with the mortgage REITs. Something to keep in mind, though. I mean, the idea, banks have a lot, but considerably less commercial real estate exposure than they did post Dodd-Frank. A lot of this debt we're talking about is already broadly defined private credit. It's debt funds, things like that. And the reality is a lot of these debt funds don't have the capacity to take keys on anything. They're not really in a position to actually foreclose. And so extend and pretend, modifying terms, or trying to sell a non-performing loan as close to par as possible are their only sort of paths forward for troubled credits.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot of debt capital, I would say, that is structurally incapable of foreclosing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you're a student of markets. How do you generally feel about where we are right now?
Well, where I generally feel right now is to be very happy to be a sector specialist and not a macro trader or a PM or something like that. I mean, my view of markets is probably less about valuations or a path of rates and more about a historical context of us moving away from a political economy that we've had since the late 80s to something new. You know, if we think about the late 80s being the, as Fukuyama called it, the end of history, the neoliberal order, globalization, low regulation, privatization, and free trade have dominated for 30 years with no, not only have they dominated, it's not like they've had even opposition. And sort of starting in 2016 to now, we have a government that's talking about industrial policy, both parties talking about industrial policy, both parties being more protectionist. So I think there's a lot of trends on the political economy side that will at some point impact markets. And I think when moving from this era to a new era is clear, but I don't think it's clear what that era is yet. And I would expect a lot of volatility between points A and B. This is kind of how I view things without making any big macro calls. That the only big macro call I'll make is that the way the world's looked from the end of the Cold War to 2016 is over, and what's going to be from here forward is to be determined.
That's fine with me. I tend to agree. I do think a lot of people are counting on rates coming down. I'm not so sure. As somebody that was pretty sure for a while, I'm less sure now.
Well, there's kind of like the two catalysts for rates coming down, and one is like kind of the exogenous shock that the Fed's hand is forced by something that we can't predict. And then the other is that there is some sort of, you know, whether it's AI or something, that there's some sort of, although I guess that would probably, my thing is, if you think about a technology like AI that is at least promising to revolutionize productivity across every conceivable sector and level of employment, to me that would be highly deflationary
Yeah, you would think.
And that your rates would
need... Long-term.
Long-term.
Short-term, you know, maybe not so much, because, like, the energy needs... Bob, shout out to Oddlots. They just did a podcast on this. The you know, that peak energy usage, that could be a real issue.
Yeah, yeah. So
kind of ironic to think about building out infrastructure for, like, I don't know, 2 minutes a day for, or, I mean, I know that's, like, very not true, but, you know, let's call it for an hour a day, right? We're going to invest, like, this much money in infrastructure.
Well, that's
for something that's a promise of productivity. I don't know, but I'm a Luddite sometimes.
I mean, I certainly try not to be, but I think it's kind of philosophically, like, interesting. The entropy, like, you can't escape it. You can't do all, it violates the law of thermodynamics to do all that work without the requisite energy required to do it. Somewhat, it's going to get spent, whether it's human energy or, you know, energy from the ground or however, just certain physics that you cannot escape.
Yeah. Now, circling back to a man that was mentioned earlier, Ganzi's been on this for a long time.
Yeah.
The need for energy in data centers.
Yeah.
He's been talking about it for years.
Yeah, and it's interesting to, you know, I'm just constantly repeating it, but to bring it back to real estate.
Yeah.
You know, there's only a handful of municipalities right now in the country that can supply either, or really both, the power and water to make this possible. You know, and so does that have... I was at Prologis' Investor Day. Northern Virginia is one of the areas that has the requisite infrastructure. That they're talking about converting some older logistics facilities into data centers. And so I guess the perhaps optimistic view of this is that the capital cycle will come for it, that the returns will clear the path for these for the energy and the infrastructure to get built to support it. I'm far more sanguine on the actual applications of the technology than most other people, but that probably veers more into a Luddite tendency than anything, you know, deeply researched.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see the allocation of physical resources on a promise is something that I'm interested to see how it turns out. I don't have, I guess my bias would be against it, but I don't have any good reason to be against it, you know? Just seems like a lot of effort for, like, ChatGPT. But I think I understand how it could, like, help American Express and all that stuff. But tough to say your tax dollars are going to help build out infrastructure while you may lose a job, but I guess your job morphs. I don't know.
You're familiar with Jevons' paradox, which is sort of as we got more efficient at creating energy, we didn't use less, we used more.
More?
Yes. And so with AI, I pay $20 a month for Anthropic, I pay for Claude.
Do you find it worth it?
Yeah, I do. But I also know that my $20 a month for what is highly subsidized. And for companies using it for enterprise level things, I'm not sure the degree to which they feel like they're getting the better end of this deal or not. My sense is that it's also highly subsidized for them as well. But there is a true cost. There's the cost of this infrastructure. There's the cost of the power and water. These things have a cost that I'm not sure that is being subsidized to both consumer users and enterprise users to some degree. Now, that business model to me made sense for an Uber. We will come in, we will lose money to put the competition out of business. We will lose money until there are no taxis. Good, bad, and different, I understood it. AI is deploying into a greenfield market with technology they claim is absolutely transformative. Why are they subsidizing it? You know, and so...
To get you hooked, like a drug dealer.
To get you hooked. And so after the last movie studio closes and after all the customer service departments have been disbanded, then the true cost will flow.
Yeah. So then you'd be paying a ton for it.
Then you'll be paying a ton for it. And you'll think, you know, maybe it was better to have people do
this. Yeah. It's all just one big LTV, to CAC game, right? So... It's interesting, but I agree with you. It's like it seems to be a whole lot of money spent on something that is currently not economic. That said, Gavin Baker probably knows more. You know, he's smarter on this.
I'm a big fan of a mid-century economist, John Kenneth Galbraith. I've been reading a ton of Galbraith. he wrote a book called The New Industrial State. And this is back when companies were just getting really big, right? Just got big, you know, where a company like GM or IBM was this behemoth. And what Galbraith argues in that book is that these companies invest so much time and capital and energy into the products they create, they are not going to risk facing true market dynamics the same way a small sole proprietor entrepreneur does. And so when they make that investment, they are sure that they are going to be able to generate the demand for those products. And so that's kind of what I feel like we've seen with the AI deployment. There's so many contradictory, you know, this is going to be transformative for, you know, science and technology, but everything that they've rolled out seems to be very consumer facing. You know, there's just lots of, this is much cheaper and free to use, but incredibly costly to create. There's just a lot of things that seem to be where the production of AI is itself the justification for its use. To your point about like, well, if we invest all of this capital into building the infrastructure required, then we're going to have to use it.
Yeah, well, and I kind of feel like it's an interesting thing when you say like, oh, the utilities need to scale up. And this has always been true. The value has always accrued at the edge of the internet. But to invest so much in a utility to let some of these big giant companies reap the economic rewards, part of me is like, why don't you guys build the utility? And then you can, you know what I mean? Like, why do we have to build the utility and then see your margins go up? Well, I guess the answer is because if everybody's long the SPY on a market cap weighted basis, we all participate, I guess.
Well, the largest companies today extract rents from intellectual property. That is the business model. Apple doesn't make phones, they design phones. So that is the same thing that's going to happen with AI. There is going to be a level of economic rent put on the IP and a devaluation of the, or at least a remoteness or a decentralization of the capital required to run it. It's the same way, you know, even on some degree as a company like Bird Scooters, you know, RIP. You know,
who would have thought that was a failed concept when I was walking around Venice and saw people throwing them in the river? I was like, this could be a problem.
But they built a business on public infrastructure. They built a business dumping scooters on sidewalks and streets. And, you know, yes, there was the hard asset of the actual scooters, but it was an app. It was an IP business that leveraged the capital that the public had paid for.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. And all businesses are to a certain extent. But I can't help, the inner me is like, screw you guys. You make enough money, you build the power. But I guess that's what we need a REIT for, right?
Yeah, I mean, the data center REITs are an interesting and sort of expose this is that they're absolutely crucial for this technology, but they're like the worst part of the value chain because of the physical capital required. And because of how fast it depreciates in real terms and because of the CapEx required to maintain it. What will be the real asset beneficiary of AI? I don't know, but it will be, again, it will probably not flow to that capital base. It will flow to the generators of intellectual property.
Yeah. Well, I guess get long Silicon Valley real estate or something.
Or where there's power and water.
Yeah, that too. All right, cool, man. Well, is there anything else you wanted to touch on? Or, you know, one quick thing. Are y'all ETF structure or is it funds? Like, what kind of structures are you guys running in your public vehicles?
Yeah, we have two listed products that are in ETF form. But then we also do SMAs and some sub-advisory for some other strategy. I'm not allowed to mention tickers, but the enterprise and investor can go find these listed strategies, I'm sure, very easily.
The good old enterprising investor. I wish I never read that book, but also it gave me meaning, so whatever.
I read Intelligent Investor when I was like 17, and it was like the early days of Yahoo Finance. So I like read Intelligent Investor, and then I go on Yahoo Finance. I'm like, what the hell is this guy talking about? This stuff doesn't exist.
The interesting thing is, had I read that book earlier, I don't know. The idea of treating, you know, securities as the underlying businesses, man, I'll tell you, the first iPod came out and I looked at the stock and I was like, oh, there's no earnings, so it's too expensive. And then Lululemon popped up and my wife was like, you got to buy this stock. And I was like, it's 50 times earnings. It's too expensive. Every huge winner that I've ever seen in my life has been too expensive the entire way up. I'm sure it's self-selection bias, but I'll tell you what, only one of those I could be fully retired and not worrying. So I don't care if it's, you know, some bias.
I think
try to learn.
I mean, I think if people are really honest with themselves in investing, it's the errors of omission that probably hurt the most more than the errors of commission.
Yeah, as long as you size it right. I mean, you can take a huge swing and screw yourself forever, but it's pretty tough. What is the word I'm looking for?
Grounded in reality.
I guess. Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Conservative.
Conservative. Yeah. But the book that really changed my outlook on investing, just because it was The Aggressive Conservative Investor by Marty Whitman.
Yeah. Whitman. But, sure. That's a great one.
Yeah. That, I think, more than any of the Buffett, Munger, Ben Graham stuff, when I read Aggressive Conservative Investor, it just clicked. I don't think that's true for everyone. But for me, that approach to investing made a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, Whitman, he's legit. Like, reading what he wrote people should do that.
His legacy suffers from bad timing. He retired kind of right into the jaws of GFC, and Third Avenue had not a great succession, and they had a high yield fund blow up. And I think his legacy has been damaged just by kind of the bad timing. But there were many years where Whitman, I think, had that not been the twilight of his career, I think he would be routinely mentioned with the greats. But now you just don't hear his name as much.
Yeah. Well, did he also write Dear Shareholders?
Yes, he did.
I think he did.
Yeah.
Fellow Shareholders. Yeah, Dear Fellow Shareholders. Yeah. Man, people should read his stuff.
You know what? That is the one thing legit. I hope people take away more than anything about REITs is that more people interested in investing should read Marty Whitman, is my end.
Maybe I'll just say waxing poetic about Marty Whitman, and people will have to listen to the very end to find out.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, in defense of REITs and Marty Whitman.
Oh, I love that. That's a great title.
Not bad.
Yeah,
not bad. All right, man. Well, have a great time and a great day. And thank you very much for joining the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.